Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 257 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyler, your host once again. And today my guest is Catherine Burmeister. And Catherine is an attorney in the Atlanta area, and she has a really interesting story. You'll hear how she was involved in law firms before she went to law school and served in a variety of functions in multiple different law firms, and then went to law school. And then went through a couple of different practice firms after graduating from law school. And a number of things influenced her to start her own practice, one that's pretty surprising. And we'll talk all about that. And you'll also hear how that led her to write a book. And the book is called Overcoming Addiction to the Status Quo. Very interesting title. So, I hope you enjoy this discussion with Catherine Burmeister. Catherine Burmeister, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you with us today, Catherine. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Absolutely. So I am born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. I was never exposed to the legal field as a child. No one in my family was a lawyer or even in the field. But about middle school, I'm an avid reader generally, but around that time, I think, was when we read a letter from a Birmingham jail and To Kill a Mockingbird. And together, even though MLK is not a lawyer, the idea of standing up for what's just and what is right and in the face of adversity really spoke to me. And then coupling that with To Kill a Mockingbird is what really made a point in my life and stood out for how I could make a difference for other people for the better. So I'm an A-type, I'm a planner. And from there, I kind of backtrack. If I want to be a lawyer, how do I get there from where I am? So I started exposing myself to the legal field in high school, my senior year. I did joint enrollment and I was in a small little general practice firm. And then I was in a medium size and then I went big law. So I had the fortunate position of getting exposed to a lot of different areas before I actually went to law school and settled on personal injury. And that really filled the need for me of being able to give people a voice that wouldn't otherwise have one, especially against the big insurance companies. So that's what I was able to stick with when I graduated law school and passed the bar, which was fortunate because a lot of people, you know, have to go defense and then make a lateral move. And I was very fortunately able to go straight into the plaintiff side of things. And then I opened my own law firm in 2018 due to a very tumultuous situation, which I'm sure we'll get into. And that is how I came to be on my own now.
Terrific. So, you know, it's interesting that you had so much background in the business of law before you entered law school, because as you know, the purpose of this podcast is to address the question, what they didn't teach us in law school about running a business. So you were able to go through law school knowing, or at least having been exposed to the business side of the practice of law. And so you had that kind of background to counterpose the legal training that you were getting in law school with.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate statement. But what's interesting too is nobody really opens up their books, right? And I'm not just talking about the numbers and bank account. They're just really, everybody keeps it close to their chest. And it's a bizarre phenomenon to me. So even though I had been in different law firms and I could kind of watch and observe, nobody really sat down, even my best mentors, and said, this is how you do it. So even still going out on my own was really, actually the year before that led up to me going out on my own is really was my crash course. And that's what taught me how to run a law firm. And I think, quite frankly, part of it is innate business sense, for lack of a better phrase. I think some people just have a knack for tapping into what's needed for a business and what's not.
Yeah, some people do, some people don't, you know.
Right, for sure. Yeah, that's not the general rule, but sometimes exactly. You learn by doing.
But I think you're right. It's interesting that a lot of, you know, what would otherwise be well-qualified mentors sometimes feel like they have to hold something back for some reason. And, you know, they're not as forthcoming with, you know, the training and the mentoring that they might otherwise be. I suspect that in some cases that's because if you're a pre-law student, you know, they can't be sure that you're going to go to law school and, you know, apply that as a trade. Maybe they think you're going to take it to a competitor. I don't know what the rationale is, but I have seen that phenomenon before. People say, well, I worked in a law firm for 3 years, but really all I did was open the mail.
Right.
You know, which is a shame because there could be a lot more teaching involved there. So anyway, you decided that at some point you'd seen enough and you were going to open your own practice. What was the momentum that caused you to make that leap?
Yeah. So I graduated law school. I was in a small firm, PI firm, and a lot of promises were made that were not kept. And then I was told I was a luxury that they could not afford, which is just awkward and weird way to phrase it when you're doing the best job and you know you're being productive for the firm. But I ended up leaving there and finding really my dream job, a great size firm. The partner had been doing this for 20 some odd years. He'd been defense and he had a couple associates who were around my age and very proactive about teaching us how to do things the right way and pushing us to do it without just sitting behind the scenes and pushing paper. So it was a great experience. I learned a ton by doing and we all had a good time doing it. Cut to about a year and a half after I started there, we get a call and find out that our founding partner had committed suicide. It was needless to say, and very obviously a shock. That's an understatement.
Understatement, sure, yeah.
Perhaps the most shocking about it was he left letters, and he had done this because he had been stealing from clients for 8 years. And it was really hard to reconcile working for someone who everybody loved. I mean, the community respected him. We enjoyed working for him. Would give you the shirt off of his back. And then you have this person who is admittedly, in his own words, stolen from people. It was really hard to reconcile those two things. And so the senior associate had come on as partner a month prior to the suicide. And a lot of numbers were wrong. The deceased partner had made a lot of promises and, you know, numbers out there that were not accurate. So we very quickly had to pivot. And I told that new partner, I said, look, I want to try to make this work. I think we have a good thing going. We have a good dynamic. Obviously, things are going to have to change drastically. What can we do? So I said I would go with him and we would take one paralegal and we would continue the firm. So for a year after that, it was myself, the new partner, and a paralegal. Unfortunately, it was insane. I mean, the suicide itself was crazy, but the fallout from it was perhaps even worse. And even though we weren't responsible, we didn't even have access to the bank accounts or anything remotely close to that. Of course, people understandably wanted answers and wanted somebody to blame. So even on the periphery of things, having to deal with that was very traumatic for the clients, us. Yeah. It was a lot. So my partner was handling the fallout from the previous firm. I was running the cases, a lot of cases in litigation too. And on top of that, I had one paralegal who was basically wearing, you know, 10 hats. It was insane. And it was very emotional for everybody too, aside from the obvious, you know, of what had already happened, trying to keep this firm going, be successful, help the clients we currently had. It was a lot. And I finally hit the point where I realized it wasn't going to be successful long term. My partner had, I think he had been understandably too, very emotionally traumatized. He had had a very close relationship with the deceased partner. And it really, I think, shed a lot of light on things that he maybe hadn't thought about before, about the profession, about where he wanted to be in life. And I couldn't run a business for somebody when their name was on the door and drag them along, right? Yeah. I couldn't make those decisions. As close as we were, I couldn't make the ultimate decision on things. And at the end of the day, it's his business. He had to care about it more than I did. And I cared, I felt like, a lot more. So I decided that it was going to be best if I went on my own and did something else. And I hated doing that because I'm very much a fighter and I want to see things succeed. But after a certain point, you have to recognize that it's not going to work. And it's also maybe not in your best interest to keep something like that going. So where I decided. Oh, go ahead.
And to be painted with that broad brush, is so difficult to overcome. And obviously it was something that you had to actually make a change. And kudos to you for trying to make it work, feeling like you could make it work, but circumstances proved that it wasn't going to work. And so you started, your own practice, and it's probably a clean break. You know, when I ask people what motivates them to start their own practice, I got to tell you, it's been a long time since I had as dramatic an event such as this described to us. So you start your own practice. You're going to stay in personal injury and stay in the Atlanta area and just kind of rebrand and start again.
I did. We ended it amicably because there had been so many, tumultuous things that happened at that point. There was no sense in making things worse. So I knew he couldn't keep all the cases going. So I agreed to take the ones that were in litigation. He kept the ones that were pre-lit.
Right.
And I, mind you, let me preface this by saying too, I never wanted my own business. I never wanted my own law firm. I had always loved doing the legal aspect, never saw myself as doing the business aspect, and was happy to be an associate or behind the scenes person. But after that third time of having the rug jerked out from underneath me, I really realized that there was just no way I could go work for somebody again and put that much faith and effort into something that I wasn't going to be in more control of, quite frankly. Right. So I figured the worst that happens is I go get another job. And that point to where I was really able to let go of what was expected of me, what the right way, quote unquote, was to do of things, really allowed me to take that step and say, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. I had a full caseload, which is hugely beneficial for anybody, obviously, who started on their own. They know that that's got to get business.
So yeah, but on the other hand, you had a full caseload of contingency fee cases.
Mm-hmm.
So there's good and bad in that respect.
Yep, absolutely. And especially they were different size cases, different types of personal injury. So, from a business standpoint, it's beneficial to have that variety. But you're absolutely right. I mean, contingency is very unpredictable. And for somebody who likes, predictability, it's kind of ironic that I got into one of the least predictable, I feel like, areas of law. But I love it. And I wouldn't change it for the world at this point.
Yeah. And I was in a very similar position when I started my practice. I took with me, what amounted to taking with me, basically the day I opened the door, the day I turned the phones on, an old firm that I had been doing business with said, hey, I got 18 PI cases that need to go into litigation. Can you take them? And I said, of course I can, because I had nothing. I had zero cases at the moment. But, I had a lot of obligations and no money coming in. So you get those cases. Now you got to hustle to try and either settle them or litigate them so that you can, create some cash flow. So there's its own pressure there for sure. So, as somebody who didn't envision seeing themselves as a law firm owner and now being thrust into that process, even though you have an established caseload, what were your challenges right at the beginning?
Recognizing that I couldn't do it all. And you would have thought that I would have foreseen that because, like I mentioned, I've been a legal secretary, admin person, all the way up to a lawyer now. So I knew everything that went into the process. But I still thought that maybe I could do it all on my own initially. And it's just, especially with personal injury, it's just not possible. In some ways,
that's even a curse because,
right?
because you've been the legal secretary and the paralegal, you know, and the associate, you absolutely know how to do all the steps, at least in terms of the legal steps. And so the temptation there is to say, well, since I know everything, I can do everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I very quickly realized, literally like within the first week, that that was not going to be sustainable. And I remember reading, I hadn't read the E-Myth yet, but I definitely remember reading at some point the idea of investing or spending money to make money and delegating. So I knew that I had to bring somebody on to help me in terms of support staff. And so I went ahead and my last paralegal, actually, she was helping me a little bit while I found some other people, even though she had a new job. And I set myself up to be remote from the beginning to keep my overhead low. And also, quite frankly, with personal injury, people are injured. They can't get off work, especially now with technology. It's just, it made the most sense not to have dedicated office space. And I could get space when I needed it. And that's all that mattered really to me. And then obviously with COVID, it's been very beneficial. I was remote before it was cool.
Right.
So it's been very, very beneficial to stay that way.
Yeah. And so you answered, you know, a couple of those questions already. You brought in some staffing, you know, slowly in the beginning, and you were able to keep your overhead low by working remotely and relying on technology. But that age old question, we always come back to, how did you bring clients through the front door?
Right. I had to really learn how to market myself. I consider myself a personable individual, but I'm not somebody that is naturally salesy or is very overconfident or anything like that. So it just doesn't come naturally to me. So I did surround myself with individuals, a business coach in particular, that really showed me that I didn't have to become what the stereotypical salesman was to bring business into the firm. And that was the biggest revelation to me, because that's not who I am. I'm a very authentic and honest person. So that just, I think that's why I never wanted to have my own business, was I just balked at the idea of having to be salesy. And once I finally realized I didn't have to be that way, things fell into place a little bit more. So I realized building relationships was going to be my strongest asset. And if people like you and they trust you, they want to do business with you. So connecting with people that knew other individuals or other attorneys and getting my name out there and building those relationships is what allowed me to start getting referrals, either from other personal injury attorneys that didn't do litigation or attorneys that did different practice areas. And then in terms of new clients, that came through friends, family, and things like that before my SEO got up and going.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. For many years, marketing companies have focused on funnels that run for a short time, often leaving dozens of leads behind that didn't make a decision yet. Spotlight Branding has found a better way. It's called a content loop, and it's changing the way attorneys think about their marketing. This system nurtures your leads in perpetuity with quality, evergreen content that elevates your credibility and helps the rest of your marketing actually work. If you're interested in learning more, head over to spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur, to learn more about the content loop and how it can revolutionize your law firm's marketing. Spotlight Branding, more referrals, better clients, higher return on investment. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time, because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And this episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone. And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. When you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress. Okay, so you said before SEO. We'll circle back to SEO in a moment. You know, a lot of personal injury attorneys try and do relationship marketing with either the physical therapy shops, the chiropractor shops, orthopedic facilities. Did you do any of that?
I did a little bit of it. There's a group called Injury Specialists in Georgia, and they have combined all different types of doctors and lawyers, and they network within that group. So we all know what we're doing in terms of the end goal, and we all know what we're trying to reach towards in terms of cases and clients, or patients in their case. So I did do that a little bit, but most notably, I worked with other attorneys. I networked with other attorneys that didn't do what I did, or like I said, didn't do litigation. And that was the most beneficial in the long run.
I'm always surprised by, you know, personal injury attorneys who take it right up to the point of litigation and then turn it over to somebody else. I'm grateful for that because that's how I, you know, kicked off my practice. But it's always a little surprising to me.
It is. I enjoy the litigation part. I mean, I very obviously wish it would go faster, especially nowadays. But I enjoy it. It really allows you to take it to the next level. And I think there may be a difference between people that, you know, enjoy the law truly and just are doing it to do their business and get by. And that's not always the case. Some people just want to be able to get a number of cases through. But I think there's advantages and disadvantages, like most things, to running a business that way.
You said that you then ultimately also added search engine optimization as a key component of your marketing strategy. How did that come about?
Yeah, through my marketing business coach, I met a lot of great people. She was very selective in the people that she brought into her inner circle. And I met a marketing individual and we actually became friends. But I started having her do my website, my blogs, really explain how the SEO worked. Because I'd seen a number of people that I'd worked for before get burned when it came to marketing for law firms. And so really finding someone that I trusted and could just give me a cursory overview so I knew enough to not get taken advantage of was really beneficial. And it takes time. That's the biggest thing. People that make promises, you know, the marketing firms that make promises that we can get you 200 cases in a month. Well, yeah, but they may not be good quality or even relevant to what I'm doing. So being in it for the long game is really, really what worked out. And as a result of it, I've been getting a lot of cold calls for medical malpractice cases now as a result.
And that's primarily as a result of them going to your website, as a result of the SEO improvements that you've made, or is it the content that you have on your site that attracts them to you?
So it's a combination of all three. We're targeting certain areas in town that are a little bit further out because everybody does Atlanta generally. So I think that it does get saturated. Of course, as you know, personal injury is overly saturated anyway. And then you've got the big firms that you're competing against as well. And I'm not doing any ads, pay-per-click ads really, because it's just so darn expensive for personal injury to do it. And as a solo, it's just not practical. So doing the blogs, and then when I learned that the blogs are just as important as the content are the SEO there. So the percentage that the words pop up in that article, because I always looked at the articles, I was like, why are they so basic? I mean, I knew it didn't need to be lawyer level to reach other people and be relevant, but it just seemed really basic. Well, the reason is you need those words to show up a certain percentage of the time for the algorithm in Google to pick it up and actually read it as something being credible and relevant and factoring it in. So that drives up your ranking as well. And then having it be consistent.
Yeah, it's a real balancing act. And we've had a lot of, you know, SEO folks on the show and attorneys who rely on search engine optimization as a marketing strategy. And, you know, it's just, it's a balancing act. You want to, yep. You want to publish great content that is relevant and has information in it that the reader would find useful. At the same time, as you said, you have to some degree, you have to play the game to get Google to recognize these entries as being relevant to the searches that people are entering. So it's a real balancing act to find that medium point where you can be informative and effective all at the same time.
Absolutely. And I've also been doing more social media. I never used to think that that was going to be how I got cases, because it just, personal injury, nobody chooses to get injured, right? I mean, you at least choose if you're going to get a divorce, or you choose if you're going to do a will. I guess criminal, obviously, you're not choosing to get in trouble either, but...
Well, maybe you are.
No. Yeah, maybe you're making a conscious decision then. But essentially, you know, you're not choosing to go find someone and do this for you. So really being cognizant of getting myself out there. And again, it's building those relationships. So I realized quickly that putting legal material on social media, nobody cares, quite frankly. Even if you're following lawyers and lawyers are following you, they're just like, meh, it's not as engaging. But what I'm really selling for, I hate the phrase, but what I am selling is myself. How am I different? And what kind of experience can I provide my clients from other attorneys? So I shifted my perspective on social media to just being myself and being authentic. And I have kind of a pattern that I follow, but really highlighting who I am as an individual. And I think that ultimately leads people to see how I am as an attorney, my authenticity and my passion for what I do.
I'll give you a perfect example of that. You know, I blog frequently about now estate planning. It used to be family law and before that personal injury. And mm-hmm. I would blog all the time. And I would always include an image in the blog post. And oftentimes they were stock images that I paid for, never used without proper authorization. But they're stock images of, you know, in the back in the day, car accidents or people being treated for their car accidents or family law, you know, whatever. When I started doing estate planning, started doing the same thing. One time I published a blog post with a picture of my now adult daughter and her dog. Mm-hmm. And that post got more engagement than any other post, you know, ever.
Yep.
And it was the dog. And my daughter's beautiful, but so I think you're really, you know, smart in the sense that you have to be able to allow your own personality to show through. You know, there was a time when we kind of shielded our professional life from our personal life. But with social media, I'm not sure that that's a wise decision. You don't have to lay open all your deepest, darkest personal secrets. Right. But I think the degree to which you can allow somebody to see that you are really a person, you're like them, and that maybe they can like you and trust you as a person, you're going to be better off for it.
Well, and I think part of it too is it has to be authentic, right?
Yeah.
People are not unintelligent. They're very quickly going to pick up on you just BSing them. So, and like I said, that is who I am. So being able to realize that that's the best way to do it and build relationships with people that I want to work with. And do I get direct clients going to my, or cold, you know, cold clients going to my social media and saying, yeah, I want to hire her? No. But I also got a referral from an attorney I haven't seen in 10 years that I worked with at Big Law, because she had been following me and had a friend that needed a PI attorney. So I think it may be harder. It may not be as beneficial in the short term as pay per click, but if you don't have the money to do that and you're trying to stand out anyway from the people that are, you know, the big firms with billboards, why not do something different? Because that's the only way that you're going to stand out in this business when it's so saturated.
Now, having done all of that, going through all of that adversity and having to take control of a variety of different situations and trying to find that balance that we all seek between work and our relationships and what have you, led you to start an additional venture and become a writer.
Absolutely. So in my spare time, right?
In your spare time, right.
Yep.
So tell us about your writing experience and tell us about the book. And I think we can make an announcement.
We can, yes. So I'll tell you about the book. The book came out of what led me to be on my own, the suicide of my partner. Mm-hmm. I had spoken with a ghostwriter right after it happened, and it wasn't the right time. There was way too much going on for us with business, emotionally. It just wasn't good. And it was very fortuitous because about a year later, I was out with some girlfriends at a cabin, and my friend asked me, "Are you still going to write a book?" I said, it's a cool idea, but who wants to read that, right? I am a humble person that way. I just think, who wants to read my book? And she said, "I really think you should do it. I think a lot of people could benefit from that story." And not a day later, the ghostwriter reached out to me again. And she said, "I saw you're on your own now. Why don't we circle back?" And it really was the perfect time. It was far enough away from what had happened that I was able to be a little more objective about it, but it wasn't so far away that I didn't remember how it had impacted me. So I decided I want to write a story about it, but I didn't want it to just be the Jerry Springer meets John Grisham, right? Because it was enough of that to fill an entire book. I wanted some good to come out of it. And I wanted to show other professionals particularly, but really anyone, that you have to move out of your own way. And our own way really manifests in being addicted to the status quo. And so the title of my book is Overcoming Addiction to the Status Quo. And I don't use the word addiction flippantly. I genuinely believe that it is an addiction. I think sometimes almost as bad as, if not worse than some other addictions, only because we all keep buying into it and accepting it. And nobody really stands up and says, you know, here's a place you can go to get better. We just are still so hesitant to break away from that status quo. So really showing people that it's okay to do that. And you are going to have a better quality life by doing what you need to for yourself rather than what the profession has dictated or any outside force has dictated.
Well, that status quo also, I think, sometimes manifests itself in, you know, the law of inertia.
You know, absolutely.
You're in the spot you're in. And some people look at it and say, boy, it's going to take so much energy to move off this spot and to do something different. And I think, you know, that's the status quo you're talking about. It's driven by the power of inertia. It's easier not to do anything. And you become addicted to that.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with you. And it's in a very literal sense how the profession is very antiquated in so many ways. And then also from a mental health aspect, I'm a very big proponent of mental health. Everybody can benefit from focusing on it for themselves. And I think that's really what traps us in there as well is, like you said, it's hard. Nobody said it was going to be easy to overcome it, but it's hard to sit there and say, what do I want to change? Whether it is about your business or yourself or both. The reason it's so many people do it is because it's comfortable, even if it's maybe not the best thing for you.
Well, what are some of the types of things that you talk about in the book as to how somebody can break that addiction?
So the first thing, you have to actually accept that you are in that position where you're not happy. And I think so many people, especially people in the legal profession, a lot of the other professions that I target with the book, zero-sum professions, so doctors, lawyers, elite athletes, executives, even nurses, we fall into this false dichotomy of if we're not winning, we're losing. And that permeates not just from our cases or patients or games, it permeates to our personal life as well. So really acknowledging whether you're happy or not with that. And I think so many people, their knee-jerk reaction is, of course I'm happy. I have a home and I have the car and I have the family and 2.5 kids. And I'm not saying those things don't make people happy, but I think happiness comes from within. And so many people haven't sat down to look at that. So really focusing on whether you're happy internally or not. And if not, finding out what could make you happier and what do you want to change, and learning how to embrace what is unique about you and what you can make beneficial for your life, and not necessarily what everybody else or your profession is telling you is best in the long run.
And as we know, there's plenty of attorneys who have that house, have that nice car, have those 2.5 kids, have that family, and in the quiet moments by themselves can only admit to themselves that they're really not happy with that. They feel stuck.
Yep. And it's really sad because I was in that position, and I really hit my rock bottom, and I've managed anxiety and depression my entire life. And obviously going through what I did with my former partner and everything, it all came to a head, quite frankly. And something shifted in that. And I would never wish that on my worst enemy, having to go through what I did, that experience. But it was one of the best things that did happen to me, because finally, I not only knew intellectually that I was enough, I believed I was enough. And I believed that I could do it and move past that, what other people thought. And that's a very freeing position to be in. And I understand how hard it is to get there, because you can know it's better for you all day long. But like most things, it's hard to get there.
Exactly. I know I should hit the gym, but sometimes it's just hard to get there.
Yep, exactly.
Catherine, tell us again the name of the book and when does it become available?
Sure. It's actually coming out today, March 15th. And the name is Overcoming Addiction to the Status Quo.
And I'm certain we can buy it anywhere we buy books.
Yes, you will be able to buy it anywhere that you buy books. Amazon, my website, you'll be able to go to. That will link you to other places as well.
Terrific. So tell our audience how they may reach out to you if they want to follow up with anything you had to share with us today. What's the best way to?
Absolutely. The best way to get me is Linktree / KF as in Frank, Burmeister, B as in boy, U R, M as in Mike, EISTER. And that has all my social media, my website's on there is the best way. And genuinely, if anybody has any questions or wants input or anything like that, I'm always happy to be a resource for somebody.
Terrific. Well, we'll include all of that in the show notes, and we wish you a lot of success with the book. I can't wait to get a copy myself. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists, Daylight, and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility, and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.